So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is the Media Podcast, and before we start, big thanks to Media Masters, Paul Blanchard's podcast about the media, where you'll hear amazing one-to-one interviews with creatives and execs. You can find out who's on their latest episode a little later. Hello, I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, we have a winner, as Impress is chosen by a panel to be the official press regulator. But will anyone join it, and what happens if they don't? Also on the show, Matt Deegan will be here to analyse the latest radio ratings, so you don't have to. Culture Secretary Karen Bradley outlines the options for Channel 4, and we have the gossip from MIPCOM and the Radio Academy Awards. All that, and a media quiz. Why very not? It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining us at the Hospital Club today are two fresh faces to the programme, but each experts in their field. First up, I'm thrilled to welcome the broadcaster and writer Dotun Adebayo. Hi, nice to see you at a time where like the sun's pouring in.
I don't come out like this in the daytime normally. Yeah, but me and Dracula, you know, we keep our hours, we do.
Give us a potted history of your career for people who don't know. I'm alluding, obviously, to the thing you're most famous for.
Well, I'll tell you what. I started at the BBC when I was 12 years old at the World Service, literally went up there and offered to help them, and they thought I was joking. And whilst I was there, some telex came in French, and I used my sort of schoolboy French to translate it, and they saw how keen I was and invited me to come in. That was on the World Service, African Service at the time, Network Africa. So I worked
with some... You're outing the service that was exploiting children back in the 1970s. What do you mean they just invited you to come in? Only in the school holidays, I hope.
Yeah, of course. And weekends I came in as well. So I worked with the legendary Hilton File, amongst others.
And you've also been overnight on Five Live during the US election cycle. We're going to meet a real-life American in just a second. But how have you been finding the debates?
It's been fascinating. We've taken all the debates live. The mind boggles, let me just say that. But it has inspired our listenership over here in the, you know, in the UK. You can't imagine. I think the last kind of inspiration like this, obviously the referendum, but even more so the Scottish referendum, which had nothing to do with English audiences, not directly in any case, fired up the imagination of people here. And the Americans have done it again.
Well, next to Dotun is that real-life American. It's media analyst Kate Bulkley. Hello, Kate.
Hi. I guess I'm going to fire you up too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why not?
as you've been firing up everyone who's been reading your media journalism for the last 25 years.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
We've got some real veterans on the show today. Kate, has there ever been a more exciting time in media journalism?
Oh, never. I mean, I think that right now it's amazing what's going on. I mean, I'm obviously a business media journalist, so I'm very interested in how the businesses are shaking out. So when I look at sort of, you know, the AT&T Time Warner bid, when I see, you know, DirecTV being bought by AT&T, when I see Comcast NBCU, when I see Netflix putting $6 billion into original content next year, all that kind of stuff is fascinating to me. And then, of course, we just mentioned the election. I mean, there's a media story there that isn't going to go away, even despite who wins, if you see what I mean. So, I mean, if we get Trump TV, that's really going to be scary, but anyway.
That isn't just like a conspiracy, is it? The most popular theory I've heard talking to people about what's going to happen in the US election is Trump's going to lose, but he's going to do better than people think. I mean, everyone's predictions are always wrong, of course. And then what he's going to do, because he's hired all these people from Fox News, is he's going to launch Trump TV. That seems to be like a genuinely most popular prediction I hear. You're both nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's definitely something he could do, probably will do, would probably love doing. I mean, Roger Ailes he's got a job opening in his CV, so he could go run it. I mean, I it's an interesting time in American politics. As an American who's lived outside of America now for over 25 years, it's kind of strange for me to look back because I don't really feel that American anymore, even though I sound American. And I did vote in this election. But what's happening in terms of the media, it's so shrill now over there. I mean, there's a shrillness and a sort of accusatory tone to the way not just this campaign is going, but the way all of sort of journalism, particularly television journalism, is going in the States, that I think is really kind of scary.
I suppose if Trump TV does actually launch, then suddenly Fox News' strapline of being fair and balanced will actually seem reasonable by comparison.
Yeah, it might.
Sarah Palin will just seem, you know... seem like Hugh Edwards. Right, let's talk about some British media news stories. And this week, the government-funded press recognition panel finally approved a press regulator. Its name is Impress, and despite being the only organisation to put itself forward, it's taken several years to actually reach this decision. Now, that may be because some of the national papers have, in the meantime, set up their own regulator, IPSO, which sought to mitigate some of the impressively harsh punishments dreamt up by the government after the Leveson inquiry. At top of the list is that any publications that don't join Impress will have to pay legal costs for both parties in a defamation case, even if the publication wins. Kate, what do you make of this situation and the fact that none of the national papers have signed up to Impress?
Well, I mean, that's the main point, isn't it? I mean, they've set this thing up and there's nobody actually a member yet, as far as I know. So that's the first problem.
Well, they'd point out there's hundreds of members, but of course none of them are the Sun or the Mirror or the
Exactly
Mail.
Right. Yeah. I think where I start with regulation is I always think self-regulation is best. I think, however, in this case, because the self-regulation body that's been in place before Impress came on the scene is basically, let's say, controlled by some very big media beasts who have very different approaches to what is maybe right or wrong or where they should be on which side of the fence, that's why we've gotten into some trouble on this, and that's why this thing came up. My concern about Impress is that although it seems to be, oh, this is great, this is very impartial, look who's funding it. I mean, that they have, there's an axe to grind there too. So I don't think it's the perfect solution. You know, maybe it's good to have a second one, but, it's a very complicated area.
And who's funding it are charities and organizations linked to Max Mosley, mm-hmm. who's been the sort of nation's biggest press crusader.
Yeah, and he obviously has an axe to grind.
He does, but he also has pots of money, doesn't he, Dustin? And I suppose that's what's unusual about Max Mosley. He was wronged by the press. Even the press now admit that they were probably wrong to report that story in the way they did. And yet he's rare in that he's got enough money to try and sort it out and work with Hacktoff to fund money into this sort of incentive. What's wrong with that?
Well, it shouldn't be down to him is what's wrong with it, essentially. And the problem with the press, I don't have any silver bullet solution to it, but part of the problem with the press, and I have worked for the Murdoch Press, I was a journalist at the News of the World, and also I'm worried about this new body because, does it include book publishers, of which that's my, day job, if you like. There are times when book publishers are no different from newspaper publishers in that they publish things that you could argue were news, as it were. But the problem with the press regulation as it is that the press feeds and wrecks the lives of the weak. So we're very careful in suggesting that Donald Trump's wife is a plagiarist or whatever else she might be, but we're not at all careful about saying the bloke next door is a paedophile, for example. I know the Private Eye won a case this week about a police officer that they had called a paedophile many years ago, and it turns out he is a paedophile. Granted, that kind of works in that way because there is some serious investigative journalism, but too often the press is more afraid of those with power, with money, essentially, because they know that they can strike back. We don't have a way of protecting ordinary people. The press is conscious of it libeling somebody with money. So that shows they are sensitive to issues of losing out in a libel case in court. But for an ordinary person that they know isn't going to stack up to sell their house to take the News of the World or Sun on Sunday, the equivalent, to court, then it's an unfair challenge.
Yeah, but the thing is that, like, the Hacked Off campaign was not about the small man in the street. It was about, you know, I mean, Hugh Grant was part of it. I mean, there were, you know, big celebrities were,
but even
were
so,
upset about the fact that they were getting, you know, blasted in the press wrongly or rightly. Obviously, Max Mosley is a good case in point.
But, so but it's they not would say, just, so we're famous and we've got is, money, but we're defending the ordinary people.
Yeah, so what you're saying is basically Impress hasn't solved the problem. The problem is for the little guy in the street, the man next door, he doesn't have any kind of protection. And, I'd go along with that. This hasn't really solved that problem.
Yeah. Here's the thing I don't understand. This might be very, very simplistic, so forgive me. But for everyone who's listening to this who actually finds press regulation a bit sort of turgid and difficult to understand, yeah, there was this big scandal a few years ago. Millie Dowler, Hugh Grant, Max Mosley, la la la. We saw Leveson, we saw the whole thing being broadcast on the telly. The implication was everyone accepted it when it came out and said, we're going to put this in place, we're going to stop this happening again. And then over the years in between, everyone just somehow managed to find a way to muddle out of it and say, actually, no, we don't really fancy that. What? That's the bit I don't get. Like, you can't opt out of Ofcom, so why can you opt out of the press regulator? Why is that a thing?
Because the press is more powerful than the regulator.
So it's about the government not actually wanting to force the press to do anything.
Oh, yeah, because they're not going to invoke, what is it, Article 40? There's no way the government's going to do that. I mean, they would have to be pushed to the wall and, you know, thumbtacked there before they'd do that.
The press is fortunate in that its right to publish what it wants to publish is, although we don't have a constitution in the way the United States has a constitution to defend your right to say anything you want, but the press anchors its freedom to that sort of human rights, if you like, to be able to say something in public freely and so on. And there isn't a single member of any party, I would think, that would restrict that, because they themselves say things that you'd think is beyond the pale, but within Parliament, they're allowed to say whatever they like and libel people and get away with it. So that there would be question marks about that, wouldn't it?
And then, as if to make this worse this week, there have been a couple of stories around IPSO, the regulator they all seem to want to join, which haven't been that positive. They ruled that Kelvin McKenzie's article on Channel 4 News, you remember we discussed this on the show, reporter Fatima Manji was criticised for wearing a hijab whilst covering the attacks in Nice. They ruled that that article was not in breach of their guidelines. Firstly, on that, Dotton, do you think that was a fair and right ruling to say, yeah, it was absolutely reasonable in a free press to say
no.
That?
I really say no.
I think probably
it was letter
balance,
of the law, but I don't think it was right.
I don't think it was right for him to have made that statement. However,
either.
In terms of their ruling, I think it was probably correct. However, it's the implication of his comments that I'm more worried about. As she herself said, Fatima herself said, look, I don't mind somebody criticising me for the way I look. I don't mind that. But there are consequences here. If you're sort of encouraging people to take action, that's action against me personally. I've had that kind of vitriol on Twitter, and it's not nice. You're in a very lonely place when it happens to you, to be honest. And I think that you don't know what the consequences of pointing an attack like that to somebody because of the way that they look results in.
Well,
but also
it.
the implication that Kelvin made was basically that this woman, because she was wearing a hijab, shouldn't have been reporting on this event, because what about all of us that are worried about Muslims hurting us?
That's how he got away with it. That's how he got away with it, by saying this is an old trick of the press, by saying, look, it's not me personally saying this, but can you imagine what everybody out there must be thinking?
But what an awful thing to imply.
But in fairness, in a free press, there's nothing wrong with saying awful things. That's how lots of columnists have their job, isn't there? But it is just when it steps over into saying someone cannot wear,
she shouldn't have been on
any religious symbols in the news and talk about that group.
If you didn't know the background to it, Fatima says it had been planned that she would be on screen on the road for that program. However, if you didn't know the background, you would think, wouldn't you, hang on, Channel 4 trying to make a point with this. They're trying to make a point.
Possibly.
Because you haven't seen her on the TV before. Suddenly she appears out of nowhere. I think that's a valid sort of question mark to pose.
Okay. But
should they have pulled her?
No, not at all. Good for them for keeping her on. Absolutely.
But then the other thing that happened this week is just days after the ruling, Trevor Kavanagh, who's on IPSO's board, used his column in The Sun to criticise Fatima Manji for having made the complaint in the first place. I mean, even if you think Kelvin McKenzie wasn't being racist and it was just his opinion, he was right to say it and it was right of IPSO to clear them, surely a situation where the regulator themselves have board members that then criticise people who come to them asking for a ruling, that's not a tenable situation.
Well, it would sort of maybe make you think twice before you went to them. right? If you know you're going to be raked over the coals for having gone and made a complaint.
Exactly, I mean, and that's crazy. The problem, isn't it? People think that's exactly what he was trying to do.
Well, she probably wouldn't have felt the necessity to make the complaint if she wasn't from the marginalised community that she comes from. Remember, she now stands, whether she likes it or not, as a representative for every other Muslim woman who wants to broadcast the news on television. If she doesn't make the complaint, then it just goes away and the next person is liable to be attacked in a similar fashion. If she makes a complaint, she does actually stand up for, I mean, women on the one hand, Muslim women on the other hand, and Muslim women who choose to wear hijab on the third hand as well. She's actually making a really viable political statement there. So I'm not concerned about the fact that they've declined against her complaint. I don't have a problem with that at all. But I think that she had to make the complaint because of who she is and what she represents.
Right, well, I know what you're thinking. Press regulation is all very well, but what's going on in the quarterly radio ratings?
Oh,
yes,
right.
It's Rajar time, which here on the Media Podcast means it's Deegan time.
It's management time.
No, Matt Deegan, our man on the inside, he's like Chico time, but you know, for media industry bots. Every quarter, the radio industry publishes ratings for live listening across analog, DAB and online, and we ask radio consultant Matt Deegan from Folder Media to give us his highlights.
So Q3 2016, always the summer quarter can be a little bit random because people change their behaviour over the summer. Some holidays for kids and also for families. So you get situations where a lot of London listening has declined, but it'll probably pop back up next quarter. Also, that has affected the breakfast shows. So Radio 1 and Radio 2, Chris Evans and Nick Grimshaw have both seen their audiences drop, partly driven by that summer effect. Not great news for Nick Grimshaw, who's had a bit of a torrid time on his ratings for the past couple of years. This is his lowest ever, but I'm sure we'll bump up a little bit next quarter. Radio 1 as a whole, actually not too bad. They had a shock of a book last quarter, but they're approaching back to 10 million, which they see internally as quite a core figure to be on. For the big radio groups, mixed bag. In London, what you're seeing is a very, very tight race on market share. Whilst LBC is leading with 5.1%, and it has this market share that even though its reach isn't super high, people who listen to it love it, so give it a lot of hours. Then Heart and Kiss are tied at 4.4%, Capital at 4.3%, and Magic at 4.1%. All so close, and every quarter, one's above the other one. Pretty much, you can't break them out. When we look at the big two radio groups, Global has done well with the Capital Network. They added Juice not so long ago, the Liverpool radio station, which has helped fortify its numbers. They now reach 8.7 million people and generate 50 million hours. Heart as a network is approaching a reach of 10 million. They've just added Heart Extra, which is their nationally delivered version, a kind of fill-in-the-gaps version of Heart, which on its own has generated 660,000 listeners. Poor Chris Moyles. It's interesting. Radio X has a real challenge. Across the country, it's done really well. It's got its highest ever network reach, and he's done quite well nationally. In London, they still have lots of trouble. I think it's that problem, you know, Radio X is a different radio station to XFM, and so they lost a lot of listeners from the old XFM, haven't been able to really gain them in the capital. But should they manage to do that, that would kind of transform their national numbers even further. So mixed bag for them. Capital Extra, in a similar situation a couple of years ago, and now has its strongest ever national numbers. Over at Bauer, Kiss has taken a bit of a hit in London and the network, but its sister station, Kistery, has done very well. It's now the biggest commercial digital-only radio station with 1.6 million listeners. Magic has had some tough books recently, bit of recovery this quarter, but again, its spin-off station's doing very well. Magic Chilled, generating 240,000 listeners, and Mellow Magic, up to 380,000. And the Wireless Group, owners of TalkSport and Talk Radio, now owned by News Corp. Not so hot for the sports stations, which have seen about a 12% drop. Talk Radio, its new relaunched speech service, it had a good book, up from 224,000 to 300,000. Its new Virgin Radio, not so good, falling back a little bit from 400,000 last quarter to, I think, just around 350,000 in this one. Looking at the numbers, lots of news about digital stations. So 4Extra's over 2 million, 6 Music had its highest ever reach at 2.3, and obviously those strong numbers for Kistory. Is this a problem for local radio, for those historic analogue local radio stations? What we've seen is that Bauer's local stations in England had a bit of a torrid time. Hart's pretty flat. Is all this new growth coming at the expense of the heritage radio stations? And will they have to come up with something new to do in the next 12 months?
Matt Deegan there. Dotton, do you think digital radio listening is eating up local radio listening? You've done a lot of time on Radio London.
Well, yeah, indeed. And I'm very fortunate, having an overtime programme, to absorb a lot of the BBC local radio stations. You know, they all select 5 Live after a certain time in the night time. So my ratings have gone up. I think 1 in 4 or 5 people listening to radio at that time of the night listening to me, if I may plug that really impressive figure, as good as any others. But the problem for that, and I mean this from a BBC London perspective, much more so than a lot of the provincial stations that probably have an identity. BBC London is a different kind of beast to all the other BBC local radio stations, and it is so dependent upon being distinct from the national stations. And yet, if it takes 5 Live overnight, the listeners are thinking, hang on, what's the difference? And why am I just not locked into 5 Live throughout the day? It gives me a very similar thing to what BBC London does. So I think the emphasis is always going to be on the national station, and it's going to outdo the local stations. Where you have local stations, you know, BBC South or TV South or whatever it might be, I think that they're able to stamp a much more clear local identity onto their wavelength than something like BBC London. BBC London loses out. In the old days, I remember when BBC London wanted to call itself BBC London Live and then take 5 Live overnight, and you're thinking, well, you're better off taking the world service if you're a BBC local radio station, because it's something so distinct that your listeners come back to you. But if you're taking 5 Live, you're on a hiding to nothing, I think.
And Kate, Matt mentioned Chris Evans there. It's still the biggest breakfast show in the country, isn't it? And it could just be a summer blip, as he said. But do you think this is to do with the dalliance with Top Gear hurting his personal brand?
Oh, I mean, Chris Evans is a little bit of a, you know, either like him or you don't. He's kind of a Marmite character, I think. Yes, I mean, maybe, you know, there's something called cross-promotion. If you're on telly, it helps. If you're on radio, if you're radio, it helps. If you're on telly, I mean, you know, there's that kind of thing that's going on. Did it hurt his brand, his personal brand? Did people get mad because he failed with the Top Gear thing? I don't know. I mean, I think if they like him, they're going to continue to listen to his show. I don't think we should read too much into this. My view is it probably is seasonal, and that if you like Chris Evans, you're going to keep listening to Chris Evans. Now, that said, people do get by their sell-by date. Maybe he's not as edgy anymore. I mean,
not on Radio 2, they don't.
Yeah, well, I mean,
stay there till they die.
Yeah, well, in terms of his brand.
Retiring this week at the age of 90.
90, Radio that's 2. Right, exactly.
So, don't knock it, he's a brilliant presenter as well. What I was going to ask though, Kate, I remember doing some stories from the United States during the time, the hiatus between the Jeremy Clarkson Top Gear and the Chris Evans Top Gear, and what they kept saying, the American commentators, I don't think Americans are going to like this sort of shouty radio presenter, and who is he anyway?
Yeah, so, well, they didn't know who he was.
But they didn't like him, they didn't like his style. I think it's a very British style that he's got, which I imagine will be rectified now with the new series, because, you know, like you say, he's Marmite, he's Radio Marmite. I think he's a good presenter, but if you don't like him, then you're not going to go anywhere else. And this is a problem for Chris Evans. Last Ray Giles, I think he had the top ever figures for Radio 2 breakfast programme. You know, you can only go down from that position, really.
If you're saying it was true.
Like Chris Moyles was once the saviour of Radio 1, and then after you've saved Radio 1, where'd you go? It goes downwards. Mm. There is a maximum possible listenership for any radio programme, I think. I don't know where it is, whether Radio 2's reached that yet, but you know, like in the music business, it's never a good thing to say this is the best of whatever artist it is, because then it stops them producing anything better.
Coming up in part two, moving on from radio to telly and asking, is Shonda Rhimes penning something for the UK? And could there be tough times ahead for CNN?
More media news in a tick. But first, let's take a break to find out who's on Media Masters this week with Paul Blanchard. Let's spin that wheel. And it's none other than John Hardy, chief executive at ITN. Let's hear a clip.
I was offered a job at the end of 2008 and started in June 1st, 2009, so it's 7 years now. And it's no secret that the company was much more challenged than I think really anybody had appreciated it was. It was actually after I had resigned from Disney but was working through some notice that the pension deficit really surfaced for ITN. And back then was a bit of a pressure on advertising revenues, and ITN was kind of losing some business, and really the strategy wasn't working out so well. So I turned up that what was I thought was going to be a growth opportunity, which turned out to be a turnaround first, and then move into the growth cycle, which we've now done.
That was John Hardy. You can hear all the Media Masters interviews for free at mediamasters.fm. Some TV news now, and Culture Secretary Karen Bradley has outlined the options for Channel 4 as the government continues to consider privatising the public service broadcaster. Kate, what is Karen Bradley considering?
The last Culture Secretary was very pro-privatisation, let's say, was putting that really into the ring. She has been a lot less pushing on that particular button. She still says she's looking at it. She says she's looking at four different options. One is do nothing. One is some kind of privatization. One is, the one that I think is really interesting, is letting Channel 4 develop some more income streams. And the other one is just reduce costs.
Okay,
and
talk us through the income streams then.
The income streams is the one that I think is the most interesting, because my belief is that Channel 4, that's exactly what it has been doing, and it should be allowed to do more of that. I mean, it's an interesting beast, Channel 4. It is a public service broadcaster, but it doesn't get any public money, right? It's totally funded by advertising. So they've done very well with that. They've also done very well with trying to figure out how to navigate the digital world. They have all these registrations now to get people to go to the online site. They've been doing targeted advertising. That's all well and good. They've been putting money into independent production companies and sort of a founders fund, kind of get these little guys going. They're going to probably sell out of their first investment in that, make a few quid. That's good. The one thing that Channel 4 hasn't been allowed to do because of its remit and what it was set up to do is it doesn't own production companies in terms of owning the content creation. You know, I think that that's something that should be revisited, in my humble estimation. I think that they've helped spur the independent production industry in this country, but, you know, if they need to get some assets to get some more money, this is a great way to do it. Instead of privatizing it, because if you privatize it, you then have shareholders who want money because it's a private company. They want a return. Very different cat. Suddenly you're hostage to shareholders are saying, where's my dividend? Where's my return? Why aren't you growing my business? You know, that kind of stuff. As opposed to, if you're trying to be a public service broadcaster, putting that money back into creating more different, great, edgy programs, which is what Channel 4 is all about and should remain being all about.
And is it right for the government to keep revisiting this? I mean, obviously, you know, the public does support Channel 4, so they have a role. But it seems quite clear from Channel 4, the message that's coming across, even in their advertising targeted at consumers at train stations. Can you please leave us alone, government? We're fine. So if they don't think there's a problem, what's the problem? Why are we discussing it?
It's almost like a solution chasing a problem. I mean, governments tend to like to, you know, mess around with things. The other thing is that they think they can make a couple of, quid. Channel 4 is probably worth about $1 billion. So, you know, that's nice for the Treasury, but it's really nothing in comparison with what the Treasury raises, right? So it's almost like they're putting so much emphasis on this. I think my humble estimation is that the last Culture Secretary, John Whittingdale, sort of wanted to go in and do something. He sort of wanted to be known for doing something, and he thought, well, this is something I can do. Privatize Channel 4. Yeah, tick. And, you know, I've never believed that it was the right thing to do. I don't think that the management is doing a bad job at Channel 4. I don't think Channel 4 has lost its way. They don't have their begging bowl out as the prior management did with Channel 4 saying, oh, we need more money. They're not saying that. They're actually saying, let us do what we do best. We're doing okay. And actually, their advertising is doing pretty well, given that we're going into a down advertising climate for TV. They're still getting a very good share of the advertising in this country.
I mean, Dawson, this is going on for years and years, isn't it? It's almost like the kind of Heathrow expansion decision, but in broadcasting.
Yeah, it's right. But at the moment, most people want to know about how Channel 4 nicked the Great British Bake Off off the BBC, to be honest. And that was a coup. That was probably as political as you're suggesting the whole, you know, conversation is about Channel 4, it was probably a political decision to say, look, we can do this as well, and the government better take note of that, I would think.
Well, it was also, I mean, it's a commercial broadcaster. They need something like Bake Off in order to get good advertisers to come in. They need big shows. It's not like they just need the stuff that we all like, you know, Unreported World, all that kind of stuff is good and edgy and fantastic, but they also need some big shows to get the advertisers
but
to come in.
Isn't that the point, though, that they're saying to the government, this is what we need, this is how we are, this is what we are today? It's a very different Beast Channel 4 today than when it was launched, you know, 30 or so years ago. Mm-hmm. It's almost unrecognisable. Then we always thought of Channel 4 as being the channel that did, you know, the ethnic stuff or a little bit of sex, a little bit of quirky stuff that you couldn't see anywhere else, which arguably is Channel 5 now. But Channel 4 is different from the way it was, very different. And I don't know if the government's quite aware of that.
Mm. It is hard to imagine Great British Bake Off on the 1980s Channel 4, isn't it?
Impossible.
Yeah. Unless it was presented by Janet Street Porter and someone was not there.
Of course. And Normski was there saying, yeah, well, yeah.
We'll leave that because we're going to come back to Channel 4
Normski's
a lot.
Normski's a mate of mine, by the way. I can do that.
I thought it was a devastating accurate impression. That's why I had to wrap things up. Let's talk about American telly. And Time Warner could be snapped up by the US's biggest communications company, AT&T, after they offered a buyout for $85.4 billion. So, Kate, in your estimation, that's probably about 75 times worth the value of Channel 4. Is it worth it?
Is it worth it? It's a lot of money. But I think that there's a couple of things going on here. First of all, AT&T is essentially a phone company, a telecommunications company. They did a year ago shell out $50 billion for another little company called DirecTV, which is kind of like a Sky TV type equivalent in the U.S.
Except satellite
isn't such a big deal. Well, it's Sky TV.
Yeah.
Right. And now they're looking for Time Warner, which is usually a content company, so they want more content. So they have deep pockets. Second of all, they are a telecommunications company that wants to move up the food chain. They call it making themselves more vertically integrated, right? So they own everything from the distribution all the way up through the content. Is that a good thing? Well, I think actually they would argue that it's all about scale. And I would agree to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at the NBCU-Comcast merger, which was about, I think it was about 4 years ago, that was the same kind of thing. The idea that you needed to have scale, Comcast is a cable company, so distribution, NBCU is a content company, Paramount, all those things, so content. You need scale to make it work in the U.S. You can't actually get anything done unless you have scale. So I think that's where they're coming from. I also think to a certain extent, and if I was sort of being a cynic, it's almost like a Hail Mary. You know, we are a telecommunications company. If we are going to make this work, we are going to have more control of content. Now, that said, the argument against this happening is that there's some regulatory issues. And also, I think, in a way, when a phone company says they are going to control content, it's always a bit of a misnomer. Because the content companies, you know, if you're HBO or CNN or whoever these channels are that they're going to get, they want to be on every platform. They're not going to become hostage suddenly to the AT&T platform, right? So there's still going to be that. So yes, they control it, but not really. Do you see what I mean? So again, it's about scale. And will the scale allow them to make the deals that they need to make? Will the scale allow them to say to customers, you need to have our service as opposed to the other guy's service because we have all this great stuff?
And in three syllables, AOL, that's a warning from history, isn't it?
Well, the AOL deal was a very different deal in the sense that AOL was a complete, you know, it was really a startup, if you think about it. It just went boom, and it was all, you know, it was the online giant, and they snarfled up this, you know, big content company. I mean, everybody at the time went, Jesus Christ, you know, what does AOL actually have in terms of assets? Look at Time Warner. Look at all these great assets. How can they possibly be buying it? But again, it was that sort of, oh, my God, we're going to miss the train if we don't get this together. Time Warner has always been like that. It got separated from AOL. It's like it always is the kind of the beautiful content child that everybody wants to own because when they're trying to figure out their next step. I think it's a very different deal. I think it's a very different time as well. I think that now there's a lot more argument to do a deal like this.
Yeah, it wouldn't be weird if Facebook bought Time Warner now, would it? People would understand.
And, you know, you could argue, why did AT&T do this bid now? I mean, 2 weeks before an election? I mean, there's this whole issue about Trump saying CNN and, you know, everybody's worried about, you know, that. Why would they choose now? Well, I'll tell you why. In my opinion, they did it now because they thought, what if somebody else comes in, like a Facebook? I mean, those guys have deep pockets, like a Google.
sure.
Let's talk about CNN, Dotton, because they're part of Time Warner. They've had a really great commercial year because of Trump.
Of course, of the election. And you were saying earlier about this election, it's the election that keeps on giving. We'll always give, at least for the next few years. We know the journalist students are going to be studying this one. CNN have done a really good job, I think, in breaking down. They're a great broadcaster in any case. You know, you're not going to get much better than CNN. There are two names in news broadcasting that resound across the globe. That is the BBC and the other is CNN. Arguably, CNN resounds in places that the BBC doesn't resound. Of course, Al Jazeera is up and coming. I'm not ruling them out at all, but it's either CNN.
Don't forget Russia TV and Russia Today and Press TV.
Well, I'll ask Donald Trump about that. He knows a lot about the Russians, very close to them, as you know. But yeah, CNN is in a good place. And because it's been, I think, aloof of all the partisan politics of this election, it will be in a good place in the next 10 years as well to look back on it. You know, the election is now going to resonate for some time to come. We're already looking forward to the next election, 2020, and I think that people will be going to CNN between now and then to find out what's going on.
And specifically on Trump, actually, because you must come up against this as well, presenting through the night when Trump is the story.
Yeah, of course.
A year ago, was it right to focus on Trump, which is what CNN did? I mean, I saw that chap from the New York Times talking to Evan Davis on Newsnight saying, we missed Trump.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that. I saw that last night.
Yeah, and CNN have done the opposite thing. They reported all of his things live, all of his rallies. It was commercially successful, but is it the right thing to do?
It was, because he was the only news in town. He was the headline. You see, the mistake that Trump has made now towards the back end of the election is to try and get, to try and explain 3,000 emails from Hillary Clinton. That is not a sexy headline. The sexy headline at the moment is, what did he say about women? Before, he was very, very aware of how to snatch those headlines from everybody else. And the other people, the Chris Christies and all these people, they didn't know what to do about it because they weren't brought up in Jeb Bush. I mean, he fell at the first hurdle because the kind of politics that he is an inheritor of from his father and his brother, that's a much more kind of like formal conservative politics. Here was somebody who ripped up the
playbook.
Entirely. And suggested that I'll say anything as long as it gets me the headline. And he was able to do that and get the headlines. If I was a reporter on CNN, where else was I going to go for
you
a story?
They had to report it. Every single night.
But you have to analyse it too, don't you? And that's something that perhaps has only really happened in the last 6 months. First year, Trump could get away with saying whatever he wanted because people thought it was just entertaining. And they did add fuel to that fire. That's what I'm...
I don't get into this blame the media game. I really don't think that that's, yes, you know, yes. The media is covering things. You know, yes, there's a certain amount of, okay, we need to cover this. How much analysis do we do? There's always that balance. You know, we've had it over in this country as well. You know, did the BBC report on balance against stuff? You know, did CNN report on balance? So there's always a thing.
But
is
LBC responsible for Nigel Farage having so much publicity before Brexit? Yes, partly.
Well, Nigel Farage was echoing the thoughts of a lot of people. To my shock and horror, I didn't realise it. You know, we live in a media bubble. We don't necessarily realise what's going on. My older brother turned round to me at my 90-year-old aunt's funeral and said he voted for Brexit. I was staggered, not because I have one feeling or another about it, but I didn't take my brother for being somebody that would vote for Brexit. I really didn't. I was completely staggered. And I think what LBC managed to do, and arguably CNN managed to do, was cut away the journalism bubble and say, let's go to where the story is. When you say analysis, if your listeners aren't interested in that analysis, that's the problem with this 3,000 emails. Who cares? What is it? Give me the smoking gun. Give me one email that says she committed a criminal offence, and then I might wake up. But you're saying 3,000 emails, as if we should analyse that and say, yes, Trump is right, there were 3,000 emails. Nobody, or most of the listeners, don't care. Speak their language, I think, is a lesson that journalists need to learn from this election, arguably from our election in 2015 as well. Speak to your listeners.
Well, and also listen to your listeners, see what they're interested in. Because I think that you're right about the bubble thing. Any media company gets into a little bit of a bubble, and you have, that's why you have to get out in the field and actually talk to people. I mean, this whole budget cutting thing, that's where we're, that's why it's such a problem.
We used
really.
To do that, you know.
You used to,
we
do,
used
that,
to
exactly.
do that.
We all did.
But very few people do that right. now. You know, we go on Google and see Google News to see what the news is
no,
or
I
what
know.
People are thinking.
No,
that won't work.
Okay, let's talk about something that's definitely a sexy headline that you would definitely be reporting, Dutton, and that is that presenter Ollie Mann and producer Matt Hill won a silver award for Podcast of the Year.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Congratulations.
Yeah, for our other show.
I'm going to get you on my pod hopping section of my program on a Sunday night. Don't worry about that.
We're doing deals here, folks. We're doing deals. That's why we're at the hospital club. If you haven't heard The Modern Man, itunes.com/MANN. Last week...
Is there an A&E here?
Last week we had the ARIAs, the Radio Academy's new awards for the industry. Let's talk about maybe some of the bigger categories than Podcast of the Year, Dutton. The BBC won most of them.
Of course, and my colleague Stephen Nolan won the Speech Broadcaster of the Year.
Deservedly so.
Yeah, he won two awards in the same week, by the way. Tremendous achievement. Are you surprised, Ollie, that the BBC won most of the categories?
I'm not, because Global didn't enter, and that's not to say Global would dominate. The BBC would dominate, but Global, specifically LBC, would probably win two or three, wouldn't they?
Of course, they should.
They should.
And I think it's an omission. It's the same kind of an omission that robbed England of winning the first two or three World Cups, you know, because England refused to take part, thinking, you know, we're, you know, Anglo-Saxon Protestants, we're not getting involved in all this South American football nonsense. So Uruguay went and won, a country that is the equivalent of Wales that will never win again. And I think that's the kind of mistake that Global are making this time around. They should have been on board from the very beginning. Partly, look, it is a sort of a conversation within the industry. Who won the Sonys? Okay. However, it is also a measure of the scrutiny of which your colleagues give what you do. As a, so particularly when you're a frontline presenter, you don't actually know what... how to, you know, I remember speaking to Bob Shannon, who you might get onto in a moment or two, years ago, about, you know, how do I improve myself as a broadcaster? And he kind of like thought, well, no, that's your job. You go out and improve yourself. But where is there to turn to? And the same for the journalists on radio. Where is there to turn to sort of learn the craft of being a great broadcaster? You do it on the job, as it were, and you have to have some kind of bar that you're aiming for. And that bar is, hang on, Stephen Nolan won the best speech broadcast of the year. Let me listen to how he does it.
And he does it by essentially not having any hours in the day where he's not broadcasting.
Well, as Bob Shannon said to me, if you want to be successful on radio, you've got to be on radio.
Yeah.
And as I've got one more for you, by the way. As what's his name?
It's a spin-off podcast here, isn't
it?
Adebayo's Shannon quips.
I'm giving away all the trade secrets here. But as Eamon Holmes said to me in his early days, he said he never, this is going back 15 years, he said he never turned down any work whatsoever because he remembers the days when there wasn't work. And that's always hanging over us like the sword of Damocles as a presenter.
Can I just make one point about the awards and radio awards? Of course the BBC is going to win most of the radio awards. It's just the weight of the BBC listenership for radio. I mean, I'm involved with the Broadcasting Press Guild Awards, and we'd give two radio awards a year, one for Radio Program of the Year and Broadcaster of the Year. And it's really hard to move outside of the BBC bubble for those awards. You know, it's like, I mean, who else is there? Is LBC? I mean, it's really hard to find a competitive commercial broadcaster. So in my opinion, you know, obviously the BBC is winning all these awards, but in a way we need to sort of really help promote the commercial sector because it's a good balance. It's a good counterbalance.
The commercial sector has got to take radio more seriously than it does. The BBC spends more time and money on its productions than the commercial sector.
Yeah, but you get the money from the BBC from the license fee. The commercial radio has to raise it through advertising.
But arguably, they raise more money than the BBC gets for programmes.
And of course,
but it pays its shareholders a lot of money.
And of course, some of those BBC wins were by independent commercial companies as well, weren't they, working for the BBC?
Yes, which was good.
Yeah. But they all have to keep to the standard the BBC expects. And they do it for very little money, because I've worked for a lot of those
Tell me about it.
Well, exactly. You know about it, exactly. And, that's a question that has to be asked by the BBC, whether, you know, it can afford to spend millions on the equivalent of the Great British Bake Off, but it can't afford to spend a few thousand on
a good radio program.
On a good one-hour-long radio program.
No, I agree.
Quick mention for Bob Shannon, controller of Radio 2, because not only did his station win Station of the Year, which I think is probably fair enough, but he also had a pretty good week because he is now the head of BBC Radio as well, under James Purnell. Controversy discussed in the House of Commons this week. So how many jobs has Bob Shannon got now, Dotton, as well as being your mentor and the controller of Radio 2 and Six Music and the Asian Network?
Hang on, he was my mentor. I've allowed him to leave that portfolio behind him.
But he's doing a lot. My God.
But he's doing it well. Otherwise, Radio 2 wouldn't have won that award at the IRIS. But I'm grinning, as you would if your mentor has just been promoted. And he sent me an email this week. I said congratulations. He sent me an email back saying, at least it means that we'll be working again together, hopefully, in brackets. So I don't know whether, you know, his awards will be something for me to rejoice about from a personal note, or whether it's just something for the BBC to rejoice about. But I think they have got the right man in the right position to wear several of those hats. He's had a balancing act between BBC Radio 2 and BBC Six Music. He's had a real balancing act. Remember, Six Music was under threat when he took it over. It was really under threat still, and he's managed to steady the ship there. The Asian Network arguably was part of, he was there at the ground level. One of the senior editors of the Asian Network is somebody that came from Five Live under Bob Shannon's grooming. So to the public, it might not seem as if he's been involved in all these things for a long time, but he has, actually.
But good thing, though, Kate, that there is going to be a controller of Radio 2 who isn't Bob Shannon. He's admitted that he can't do that job, that will come up for
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be doing all these jobs. It's just a lot to do.
It is a lot to do.
And certainly Purnell needed to, you know, promote somebody who actually knew something about how to run a radio station, so that was good, too.
Yeah.
Now, also since we were last on, the TV industry headed to Cannes to talk up the hot new formats that broadcasters should be buying. MIPCOM. Anything catch your eye, Kate?
Oh, there was a lot of great stuff at MIPCOM. I saw the preview screening of Halcyon, which is basically Hotel Babylon meets Downton Abbey, which is going to be a great show.
I'm in.
It's really good. That was a Left Bank production. Sony is distributing it. It's going to be really good. I mean, there was a lot of shows that were coming out from, which were Netflix-backed and Amazon-backed, which is a very interesting shift for that market, by the way. There's a lot of money coming from those two over-the-top players into content production, which is good and bad. I mean, it's an interesting time. We say that we're in the great drama bubble right now. In other words, there's so much demand for series drama that, you know, and money's just being thrown at it from all sides, that we're almost getting into a kind of a bubble-type situation. It was mentioned several times, actually, down at MIPCOM. What does that mean? Does that mean it's going to explode? Does that mean the prices are going to continue to go up? You know, what's it mean for people who are actually trying to make drama or people that are trying to distribute drama? So it's interesting. But there was certainly a lot of good stuff. And Shonda Rhimes was down there in a big way because she won one of the big accolades at MIPCOM.
She created, you know, Grey's Anatomy and Scandal.
Yeah.
And she said she might be interested in working on a UK show.
Yeah, I mean, she's made a lot of interesting things. I mean, Grey's Anatomy is probably the most well-known, but she's done Peak Practice. She's The Catch, which is something new, which is really good. I just watched the first two episodes of that. Fantastic. She is part of the ABC Disney group, so to speak. In other words, she's got a deal with them. And ABC is the big U.S. network, and they produce internationally. So what she said was, I would love to work internationally, and I'll probably do it through ABC Disney, maybe in the UK. She's worked with some British writers and producers before on some of her other shows, so it's not as if she's never, you know, come up against a British talent. But, you know, getting her to actually come and do something over here as opposed to something in the States is, let's say, more viable now that she's part of the ABC family. So we'll see.
And do you think, Dotton, that an American writer of whatever renown can come here and make a show about Britain that is actually relevant to Brits, not just for Americans who think we're all Hugh Grant?
Yeah, why not? Why not? I mean, they've got a different way of looking at things. I think they're, as we know from the new journalism, they've got a head start on us in terms of long-form news stories. So we are still trying to catch up with that. Arguably, that influenced the way Americans' novels in the late 20th century have wiped the floor with British novels, to be frank. So if they can do that in terms of novels, literally swipe the great English novel from under our feet, why can't they do that with telly?
Well, the thing about it is that what they do in America that we don't do as well here is something called writers' rooms. And writers' rooms allow you to draw on a pool of talent to create a series to keep it going a lot longer. So one of the problems with British drama, usually, is that you have one writer who gets tired because, you know, after you've written 6 episodes or 10 episodes, you're done. If you've got a writer's room and you've got 15 people in there, you know, you can keep going for 7, 8 seasons. So that's the kind of discipline
you're
that Chandra
right.
would bring you're to something she'd do in the UK. It's not like she would just write it from the US perspective. She would bring in British writers and probably do it that, but she would run it differently. Do you see what I mean?
Look, we've got a tradition, haven't we, in sitcoms of sitcoms being written by two people. Jimmy Perry, the late great,
right.
who just passed away at the age of 93, wrote with David Croft. You know, in America, they do have this sort of communal sense of, you know, writing TV together, which we don't have over here. We can learn a lot from there. They're learning from us as well, of course. With all our Shakespearean actors going over there, we've taught them how to act, let's face it.
Well, I just watched, The Crown last night, the first 2 episodes of The Crown. And, you know, it's absolutely fantastic.
Is it?
It's filmic. It's beautifully shot. The first 2 episodes are, I mean, they were wonderful. And the writer and Stephen Daltrey, who's the director, were there talking about it afterwards. And basically, it's a Netflix-funded, you know, thing. And they said, you know, it was great working with Netflix. They were given pretty much carte blanche to do what they wanted. And I'll tell you, the money certainly was flowing. There were trains. There was all kinds of stuff going on. Absolutely beautiful. But that's
and
all
my
British actors.
And my father-in-law's an extra in it.
Really? Okay. So all British actors.
I'm
you know, Claire Foy, Matt Smith. Interestingly, Winston Churchill played by Lithgow. I mean, you know, American actor.
Does he pull that off?
I thought he did.
Really?
I thought he did. Now, I'm American.
Is he looking for laughs?
He did not play it for laughs.
Honestly?
There are laughs to be had.
Laughs to be had. There was one scene in the bathtub that he had, which was kind of funny. So, yes, there are some laughs.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, there is just time for our media quiz.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
This week it is entitled, It's So Hard to Say Goodbye, because just like Boys to Men, we here at the Media Podcast tear up at the thought of our time together drawing to a close. So, what are these three media companies saying goodbye to? It's best of three. Buzz in with your name, so Kate, you will say...
Yes?
Kate!
And Dotton, you will say...
Dotton!
There we go. Someone's on top of it. The winner is Black Mirror. The loser is Russia Today. Here we go. Question number one. The BBC. What did they wave goodbye to this week? What did
great
the BBC
British
wave...
Wave... Wait,
buzzing British with your name? Bake-off. Buzzing with your name?
Oh, sorry. Kate.
Kate.
Great British Bake Off?
Correct.
Hey,
yes.
Hey, wow.
With overnight ratings of how many? Do you remember the number? It is staggering.
14 million?
Correct. 14 million people watching the final. They'll be sorry to see it go. Did you see what Netflix boss Ted Sarandos said this week about that?
Yes, he said that they were late getting into bid for Great British Bake Off. They should have made a bid, but they never thought it would leave the BBC.
I mean, we've just been talking about The Crown. Do you think the Great British Bake Off could work on Netflix, though, really? I mean, it's a sequential weekly event, isn't it?
I don't think it's really the right show for Netflix.
No, I don't think
that's,
it is.
I mean, that's my opinion. But they are trying to get into what they call more factual programming, and British Bake Off is a factual program. So maybe. But I mean, I don't think it... I thought it was a bit disingenuous for him to say that. I was sort of like, you know, really? Would you have bid big money for that? Not as much as Channel 4 did, that's for sure.
Right, question number two. Who are ITV waving goodbye to? Who are ITV buzzing with your name when you know the answer?
Kate.
Yes.
Yeah, you can tell.
Nelson, if she gets this, you've lost the quiz.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. 120 jobs.
Correct, 120 jobs to save £25 million that they say will hit the business during Brexit uncertainty.
I call this the other shoe drops on Brexit, yeah.
I mean, they've been in rude health financially, ITV, haven't they?
I know, but you know, now we're predicting that, you know, advertising revenue is going to go down because there's lack of confidence. You know, whenever you have lack of business confidence, which is what Brexit is causing, you know, advertising revenue tends to go down because people just don't invest as much. That's just the way it goes. So if I'm Adam Kroeser and I'm running ITV, I'm thinking, maybe a good time to do a little cost cutting.
Okay, well, Kate's won the quiz, but it's all to play for. Here's question three.
Hang on, she's won the quiz already.
Yes. It's best of three.
And I couldn't say my name once.
I have a feeling, though, that Dotton might actually get this one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Who did fans of Dad's Army wave goodbye to this week?
Dotton. Wait, his name starts with James.
Yes.
He's 93 years old.
Yes.
He died this week.
Yeah. Jimmy Perry, yes, who died on Sunday, age 93.
Good for him.
He was a massive influence on British comedy, number one. He was also, I was listening to a phone-in on Radio London, someone that a lot of cabbies were calling up and doing the whole I had him in the back of my cab type
stuff. Yeah, I'm sure they did, actually.
Bit of a local legend.
He sounds like he was a good bloke. He wanted to be an actor. He wanted to be in the series that he himself wrote. So he wanted to be the Spiv, what's his name, in Dad's Army. He wanted to be one of the characters in It Ain't Half Hot Mum. And sadly, that was the one series that they possibly got wrong because they were harking back to sort of a colonialist view of the relationship between India and Britain during the Raj. So it's politically incorrect to play that or to play repeats in that. But with Dad's Army, imagine my stepmother coming over here as an adult to Britain in the mid-60s and laughing her head off at what is a very, very, very British sitcom.
Yeah, I mean,
it's amazing.
And we lost David Croft a few years ago, didn't we? And then Jeremy Lloyd earlier this year as well, who co-wrote on LOLO and a few of the others. Mm. And now Jimmy Perry. They've all gone. Who is going to fill
it's
that?
End of an era, really.
They do not make them like that anymore.
No, I think it's fair to say. The thing about Jimmy Perry and David Croft is they were very good on the sort of gang show kind of thing, but there is a name for it. I can't remember. Yeah, an ensemble. Mm-hmm. Precis, an ensemble cast. They're very good at that. So you try and think, what would be the modern equivalent? You know, would it be a football team or something like that? And you can't quite see it working in the way that Dad's Army worked on so many different levels, you know?
Well, in the style of a Jimmy Perry sitcom, I suppose I should end by saying you have been listening to Dotton Adebayo and Kate Bulkley. Thank you very much. Wave at the camera and smile.
Hey!
And as the titles roll. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this show for free right now on your podcast app of choice. We're on iTunes, we're on Acast, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, Google Play, the tedious list goes on. Wherever you find your pods, you will find us. Press subscribe. And as you're now up to date with all the latest media news, why not get inspired by listening to the latest episode of Media Masters with John Hardy as well. You'll find that at mediamasters.fm. The producer of this show is Matt Hill. The media podcast is a PPM production. I've been Ollie Mann. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.